This morning we are starting another chapter in the book of Ecclesiastes, and so I want to ask you to go with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 6. Ecclesiastes chapter 6, and our text I'll read here as we begin. It's verses 1 through 9. I've made comments before to the effect that reading Ecclesiastes is like riding a roller coaster, because you feel like you're constantly being jerked around from just some thrilling truths regarding the Lord and His grace here as we make our way through life on earth, but all of a sudden being hit with the other side of the either difficulties of life or all kinds of issues in life that were not meant to satisfy us and that can frustrate us deeply if we're not viewing them in the right way. And so last week, we were at the top of the roller coaster with the exciting truths about enjoyment of earthly life. You're going to see right away as I start into chapter 6 that we are going way down. So hang on, please, and let's read Ecclesiastes 6, verses 1 to 9. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possession, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to the one place? All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. And my heart sank when I was reading one of my commentaries, and the writer said Ecclesiastes 6 is one of the Bible's darkest chapters. That sort of description makes you want to avoid it. You don't like to think about the heavy things that are mentioned here. And yet, I remembered another way that I've shared with you from a different author as to how he described Ecclesiastes and how he explained that all of this bad news contributes to the good news. He talked about the mercy of vanity, or all of these vapory things. In other words, there is ultimately a redemptive purpose to all of this bad news. And by warning us in such shocking terms, like we read this morning, God is graciously working to rescue us from wasting our lives. One of the specific factors that I think we want to keep in mind, especially as we go into this passage, is to connect this all with the end of chapter 5. In fact, let me show you something. If you will just look up to chapter 5 and verse 13. If you remember that passage, it says, 5:13, there is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. And it goes on to talk about the devastation of losing the investment and how painful that is. And he starts by saying, there is a grievous evil. We'll jump down to where we began in chapter 6 today, verse 1. There is an evil that I've seen under the sun. And it's very similar, having to do with wealth and some of its problems and how you can lose it. And in fact, the phrase grievous evil shows up to finish that part in verse 2. So it starts out with a grievous evil up here and a parallel grievous evil down here. But what is right in the middle? What's right in the middle is chapter 5, verse 18. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. This is the gift of God, for he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the joy in his heart. And so sandwiched in between these grievous evils that talk about some of the problems of wealth and earthly life, right in the middle is really the point to which he's driving. And we want to keep that in mind, that ultimately this bad news is urging us to enjoy life's things, life's material things, in a God-centered way, and that there is a proper enjoyment of it. It has that positive purpose ultimately. And last week I shared with you some thoughts about that, and I illustrated it with a certain understanding of that hymn that has the line, the things of earth will grow strangely dim. And it struck me as we were singing another song. This is not in my notes, but I thought this was perfect. This was the stanza that we skipped, okay? So it's no big deal, Brian. Look at hymn 437, okay? Hymn 437. And I want to read for you stanza 2. Hymn 437, I am his and he is mine, stanza 2. And it says, heaven above is softer blue, earth around is sweeter green. Something lives in every hue Christless eyes have never seen. Birds with gladder songs o'erflow, flowers with deeper beauty shine. Since I know, as now I know, I am his and he is mine. You know, just my personality, I read that kind of thing and I think that sounds quaint, maybe even a little cheesy, okay? I'll be honest. But that's actually exactly the point that's being made in Ecclesiastes. It's not that the poet just kind of got carried away with his language. There is a depth that only Christians can appreciate in the created world. Because through Christ, we have been united with that Creator. And we come to view those things, not just as things for us to take in and feed our faces and enjoy ourselves, but we see them as His gifts to us. And they speak to us in a special way of His grace and of His goodness, to where even the material moves us to worship Him. That is the worldview that Ecclesiastes is urging us toward. And last week, I had also shared with you from a book called The Things of Earth. Let me read an illustration that the author Joe Rigney gives to help us appreciate this. He says, my favorite dessert is pumpkin crunch cake, an autumn delight that my wife makes. It's the kind of dessert that became a meal that can become a meal replacement, breakfast, lunch, or dinner. I'm normally a fairly open-handed person when it comes to sharing what's mine, but pumpkin crunch cake is an exception. The words, get your own, come to mind. Now, in extolling the sweetness of the pumpkin filling or the crispiness of the topping or the crunchiness of the walnuts mingled throughout, it's possible that I could come to love the dessert more than my wife. The cake and my bride could be rivals competing for my affection. However, sweets versus spouse is not the only option. If my enjoyment of the cake is real and deep and satisfying, And if it issues forth in praise of my wife, appreciation for her efforts and acts of love, like doing some dishes, then my love for the cake is no threat to my love for her. She wants me to enjoy the pumpkin goodness. That's why she made it. In fact, my enjoyment of the dessert serves and increases my love for her. The enjoyment of one doesn't cancel out the other. Instead, they overlap and mutually indwell one another. And my wife is honored as a fantastic cook and a wonderful spouse in my enjoyment of her culinary creation. Thus, it's entirely appropriate, when confronted with tremendous gifts, to periodically compare love for the gifts and love for the giver. It's good to be reminded that the giver, God, is ultimate. But then, once the supremacy of the giver is settled, the right and fitting response is to dive back into the pumpkin crunch cake and enjoy every last bite. That is the thrust of Ecclesiastes' teaching about life on earth. It's just that right now, we are looking at some of the warnings not to love the cake more than you love your wife. Not to love the stuff more than you love God, the creator of the stuff. But I'm bringing that up to keep us focused on, keep us reminded of the direction toward which the dark parts of this book are always pointing. And that is the proper enjoyment of earthly life by integrating it into our relationship with God. This text does that by picturing in very bleak terms the sadness of discontentment. The sadness of discontentment. That's our theme this morning. And we're going to see here three factors that will make our lives tragically sad if we are people who are discontented because our lives center on having more and more material possessions and we are not viewing those things in connection with our relationship to God. When we are focusing on and worshiping the creation more than the creator, these sad truths illustrate the kind of sadness that we can expect. So, what are these factors that all will end up in some way or another contributing to this theme of sadness and this theme of warning us not to idolize creation? The first of them is actually in verses 1 to 2, the providence of God. The providence of God. Here's where he said, "There's an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity, vapor," there's our word, "it is a grievous evil." And it might sound strange for me to say that the providence of God can actually contribute to your life being sad. Initially, we'd want to reject that idea because, especially at the beginning, it says there is an evil. And later on, it says it is a grievous evil. And normally, we don't think of those two words, evil and God or God's providence, together. They seem to be opposed to each other. We need to understand that the word evil here in the Old Testament can be used in a very broad way. Sometimes it does refer to that which is morally evil, things that are wrong, that God would not do and we shouldn't do either. But very often it's actually used in the broad sense of just something bad, as in uncomfortable, unpleasant, something painful. And let me give you another reference that uses it with a different translation will make the point. Amos 3:6, the prophet asks, "Does disaster come to a city unless the Lord has done it?" And the word disaster there is the same one here, translated evil. It's the same root. And it's just talking about bad, calamitous disasters that happen out in society. You can talk about, well, the hurricane did this, or our enemies did this, But Amos wants to make the point that over and above all those secondary causes, there is a sovereign God who is ruling over even the bad things that we experience. And when he asks the question, does disaster come to a city unless the Lord has done it? You're supposed to say, well, yes, actually the Lord, in the ultimate sense, did do that. He did bring that. There might be different, more nuanced ways to say it. He permitted it, perhaps, in some cases. But whatever you say, you cannot somehow convey the idea that somehow these bad things are happening and God is surprised by them, that God can't do anything to stop them, that he really, really wanted to stop it, and he tried, but he failed, and so these bad things happen. Nothing escapes the superintendence of God. And that's what the author of Ecclesiastes is saying on the individual level. When he talks about God, he says that this man in this scenario received from God some good things. God was the one who gave him wealth and possessions and honor, and so much so that he lacked nothing of all that he desired. You know, perhaps he is reflecting on his own experience, as it was described back in chapter 2, that he had all of these resources, and there was no limit to what he could obtain. God gave him everything he could possibly desire, and yet it says that God did not give him the power, or you could translate that, did not permit him, literally, to eat from or to enjoy those many good things that he possessed. But instead, what God did is work things out such that a stranger ended up enjoying the good things. Now, we have questions about how that could happen. And this is a hypothetical scenario here, so we don't really have that explained here. But it actually could happen in any number of ways. Even in Ecclesiastes, he'd already talked about this kind of thing, and there are some options based on what he had said before. In chapter 5, verse 14, somebody could lose their wealth in the providence of God through a failed business venture. In chapter 2, starting verse 18, somebody could perhaps lose their wealth and end up not enjoying things like they should because the individual dies young, and then he ends up leaving his inheritance to a son who happens to be a fool and who squanders it all, and there goes all the wealth. Or in chapter 4, this could happen by the individual dying and not having an heir at all. And all that he had spent, all this effort accumulating, disappears from his name, from his family. There would be other things we could envision. Somebody could accumulate all these things and face some terrible illness or some other personal calamity that somehow prevents him from being involved with it on a regular basis and keeps him from enjoying it. And eventually it's other people primarily that are enjoying all of those things. Or perhaps the wealth could be stolen. Or he could be attacked by some powerful enemy and all of his stuff is carted off to another land to be enjoyed by another group of people. We don't really know what he had in mind here, but maybe he left it vague because this kind of financial loss can happen in so many different ways and it can happen in so many unexpected ways. Whatever was the specific event, what he wants to emphasize is that that loss is traced ultimately back to the determination of God. God is the one who gave it, and God is the one who permitted, who did not permit him to enjoy them, but who, at least we would say, allowed, if not directly sent, the stranger along to enjoy them. Now, we read that sort of thing, and we might assume that this scenario applies to the kinds of things God does in the lives of unconverted people, where you have a wealthy person who, because of their wealth, has padded their lives such that they don't feel like they need God and they're not paying attention to him. And all of a sudden, God does something to just remove all of that so that they are shocked and brought to an awareness that these things are such paltry, food for their soul, that they are lacking something, that they need to seek God. So he does use this kind of thing with unsaved people to wake them up to the folly of materialism. That is certainly an appropriate application, and it ought to be a warning to everyone who is in that condition, to anyone here who is still seeking satisfaction of heart in things instead of in Jesus Christ. And we could use some words that Jesus himself used to make the appeal to anybody like that. When Jesus addressed the Samaritan woman, he said, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." And we understand Jesus was not talking about physical water, H2O. But he says, your thirst for physical water is actually illustrative of something much deeper that you're longing for. And what you have been trying to satisfy in physical ways with all of these men that you've been involved with, you cannot satisfy the spiritual with the material. And so he invites her to himself. And he makes the invitation to all who remain thirsty after perhaps years and years of looking to material things to satisfy a God-given spiritual craving. Jesus says that will never work, and it may be that God will just yank those things away from you so you're left with nothing. And in his grace, he'll use that calamity to bring you to himself. I think that is a very appropriate application. However, I don't think that we should limit the application to lost people. The reality is that even believers, we continue to be tempted to the same kind of idolatry. And sometimes in his grace, the way God brings us to our senses, the way he brings us to repentance, is that he strips our idols away through some kind of physical calamity. And again, it might sound harsh to view God in that way, or to say that he's going to hurt me physically. He is going to cause me to go through some kind of huge economic loss in his efforts to deal with me on a spiritual level. Does God really do that? I mean, isn't that just because of the forces of the market, or just bad decisions that people make for how to use their money? How can we say that God actually sends calamity into the lives of his own people? Well, if you struggle with answering that, I would just urge you to consider, what is the alternative? That God is only sovereign over the good things that happen to you? That we can only say this came from him when it feels good, but the stuff that I don't like or that I find painful, well, that was just Satan, or that was just my enemy, or that was just the weather or the circumstances. Is that the kind of God you want to be worshiping? Is that the perspective you want to have of him? You know, last week we were thrilled with the idea of our portion from chapter 5. Which is that truth about our divinely determined lot in life that includes all the blessings we enjoy. And with that in mind, are we to believe that, as I mentioned last week, God is sovereign over even what you have for breakfast this morning? But if later today you have a car accident, God isn't sovereign over that as well? And that somehow he just messed up or forgot or wasn't able to stop it, and he says, you know, I'm really sorry, but, you know, stuff happens. Is that the kind of God the Bible pictures? In other words, even our suffering, we have to include in the concept of our portion. Remember what Job said to his wife. When she was trying to get him to curse God, he said, "Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?" Also, same terminology there. Now, in that story, we know that Satan was involved, that Satan had a malicious motive, but we also know that Satan could not do anything without God giving him permission. That's how it all started. In fact, God was the one that was throwing out the challenge. "Have you considered my servant Job?" And God lets Satan harm Job to a certain point, and Satan doesn't get his goals, and so he asks for another level of suffering, and God says, okay, but don't take his life. Even the worst of things that are taking place in that story are happening by the superintendence of the Lord over the suffering, specifically the permission that he gives Satan to carry out those things. And so, when suffering comes into our lives, as we come back to Ecclesiastes, the point of this little passage is that at least one of the questions we need to ask when we face calamities is whether the Lord is working to teach us the settled contentment with him and his purposes that this book is encouraging. Could it be that he is stripping away something that we are treasuring more than we're treasuring him? And so the sadness of his providence may be what he uses to deal with our discontentment. Verses 3 to 6 take us to the second factor involved in all of this. The second sad factor that may be associated with discontentment, that is definitely associated ultimately with discontentment, and that is the issue of death. We move from the providence of God and economic loss to the ultimate problem of death in verses 3 to 6. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he, for it comes in vanity or vapor. There's no lasting substance to it. And it goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he, even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. Do not all go to one place? Now, clearly, some of this is hyperbolic, and Solomon is talking in very extreme terms to make a point. And if you were doing a full-blown sort of theology of life and death and stillbirths and that kind of thing, you would want to add a lot of other passages, but he's making one point. We want to keep it focused on what he's saying. Some of it is hyperbolic. He mentions in this second scenario that the individual, even if he had 100 children, that sounds over the top. Although we want to remember that Solomon was involved with 1,000 women, so that it is possible that this could happen. I could have missed something, but I don't think the Bible tells us how many children Solomon had. However, it turns out that 2 Chronicles 11:21 does tell us how many children Solomon's son Rehoboam had. I hadn't really taken note of this before. It says Rehoboam took 18 wives and 60 concubines, which is a lot, but it's a lot less than his father. And through these 18 wives and 60 concubines, he fathered 28 sons and 60 daughters. So that is almost 90 children. In other words, Solomon's own son almost meets the little scenario here eventually. So maybe that was not quite as impossible, but obviously the years of life that he mentions later, 1,000 years twice over, 2,000 years, that's got to be a bit of a figure of speech. That is over twice the longevity of the longest living man that we are aware of, and that is Methuselah back in the book of Genesis. Why does he mention the 2,000 years and the 100 children? Well, from an Old Testament perspective, the way that even the Pentateuch was laid out and the normal expectations of these people, when they thought about, in a concrete way, how would I know that God is blessing me? They would probably answer with three things. He material possessions or wealth, long life, and children. Okay? And really, all three of these are involved in this context. So that this individual would have had just the fullness of these things in the most extreme imaginable way. And yet, despite those blessings, he suffered from a number of problems. It says in verse 3, for example, he is not satisfied with life's good things. It didn't mean that he doesn't have good things, but that it was never enough. He always wanted more, and he felt like to be happy, he must have even more. He doesn't even get a burial in verse 3. And of course, the idea of a burial is something very important in the Old Testament as well, and it's an indication of honor being given to you and a certain amount of attention and affection and favor that is shown towards you from your family. And again, we don't know all the details of what Solomon had in mind here, but it's a pretty sad thing that he's got 100 kids, and evidently things were so tense or whatever between him and his children, they didn't even care to bury him. He didn't have the decency of that kind of experience as far as earthly life is concerned. He enjoys, verse 6 says, he enjoys no good. Which that language seems to refer back to the positive way that Ecclesiastes speaks of material experiences. And if somebody enjoys no good, even though he's got all kinds of stuff, that is an indication that he lacks this genuine relationship with God. He is not able to engage with the Lord in a personal way through those things. His selfishness, his covetousness, his idolatry prevents him from the kind of enjoyment that Ecclesiastes is talking about. And ultimately, verse 6, he dies. Do not all go to the one place. That is the big point, really, the ultimate problem in this paragraph, that no matter what he may have had, he eventually dies. You know, he could live 2,000 years. But it's not going to be infinite. It's not going to go on forever. Everybody is going to end up in the same place, which, as we said before, that kind of language does not deny an afterlife, but it is focusing on life under the sun, that it's all going to end. Even if you are right with God, you're going to die. And here is a very sad case where an individual lives a long, long time, and you would have thought he's got it all, but even he dies. And it's no indication, really, that he, in his heart, is satisfied. Death, in Ecclesiastes, is the great leveler, puts everybody on the same footing. And you could live a couple of hours in your mother's womb, or you could live 2,000 years. And in the end, whatever those differences may be, you're both going to die. And in fact, he goes on to make the point that the kind of existence on earth that that man had, actually a stillborn child is better off than he is. Now that's a little hard to swallow. Again, I don't think he is saying everything that could be said about that situation. And maybe the point he is making is not true in every sense about everything you might consider regarding stillborn children. But at least for his point, that the stillborn does not have to go through the frustrating and depressing experience of life and death that this man without God endured. Now, there is a great sadness to stillbirth. And I'm sure many of our women, including my own wife, have suffered miscarriages. What Solomon is saying is that for all as bad and painful and awful as that is, it is not as bad as a wasted life on earth. The stillborn child undergoes a certain amount of suffering, but it is extremely brief. And he finds rest, at least in the sense of being delivered from all the burdens of a life on earth. And we would say that if you take into account the rest of the Bible's teaching, that would be so even more when you think about the what seems to be the ultimate destiny eternally of stillborn children. The Bible doesn't say a lot about that, but it certainly indicates that children in their mother's wombs are genuine human beings, that they are the objects of God's special care. And we understand the mercy of God being so great that it would seem, based on all the factors, that God takes special pity on them. And if they die in that condition on the basis of the work that Jesus did, we expect them to be delivered into the presence of God. Now, David went through something like this with one of his children. It was not a stillborn child. It was a child that was born and lasted on this earth about a week. And when that baby died, he said, "I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." And somehow that truth was the explanation for why he went from being all sad and mourning to why he was okay and at peace and could get on with his life. In other words, it was a comfort to him that "I shall go to him." It seems to suggest that he was anticipating a reunion with this child in the presence of God one day. And I just have to wonder about that when Solomon is writing this. That little boy was his brother and shared a father and a mother, Bathsheba. It wasn't a stillbirth, but it was something very close to it. And I wonder if Solomon is writing this and thinking, you know what? I think his life was better than mine in many respects, based upon all of the poor, idolatrous choices that I've made and all of the suffering that I've brought upon myself and all of my people. Maybe his life, for as short as it was better ultimately than mine. Now, we still find it hard to accept what is being said here about a stillborn child. I would guess that if we do, and I'd say this for myself, I struggle with this passage as well. Maybe it's because I don't understand how bad a godless, discontented life really is, both on earth and definitely on into eternity. One author put it this way: better to miscarry at birth than to miscarry throughout life. Another one said, "In my pastoral ministry, brokenhearted parents and grandparents have sometimes asked, 'Why did God even permit this child to be conceived if it wasn't going to live?' Solomon asked, 'Why did God permit this man to have wealth and a big family if the man couldn't enjoy it?'" In other words, we maybe aren't asking the right questions, though it's not wrong to grieve and to wonder and ask the Lord. There is this bigger question about what about this life that went on for so long and seemed to be so great, and in the end, it's a waste. And death brings it to an end, and that reality of death really drives home the point of how sad a discontented life is. And then there's a third factor. We'll close with this in verses 7 to 9. The other factor that is involved with this idea of the sadness of a discontented life is the factor of human nature and what it is that we're made of and always looking for, every one of us. When he says this in verse 7, I think he's describing all in a very comprehensive, I mean, all means all in a case like this. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. In other words, that's a general statement about the tendency of every human being. We just have this wanter that just keeps going and going and going. It never stops. It drives us all of our lives. And nothing on earth is going to satisfy it the way we want. We speak of wanderlust, right? And there we're talking specifically about people who are kind of obsessed with exploration and seeing new things and traveling the world, and this is what they're living for. And And you look at something like that, and nothing wrong with travel. But this problem of wanderlust very often is covering for an unsettled heart. A heart that just doesn't want to deal with real life. A heart that isn't satisfied to just accept the will of God about the often mundane routines of life and just get on and be busy and productive for the Lord and His will instead of always searching, always more and always more. Well, wanderlust can take other forms than just traveling the world. And Solomon says here, every one of us is afflicted with some form of wanderlust. All of us are ultimately plagued with this passion for more of something or other. First of all, because we are eternal creatures who are created for eternity. And secondly, because of the depravity of our own hearts and how easily we look to things to satisfy us on that deeper level. And then he says, verse 8, speaking some more about human nature. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? I believe the answer to both of those questions is there is no advantage when it comes to this issue. In other words, everybody's got this passion inside for satisfaction, this appetite for something more. Everybody has it. And really, whether you're a wise man or a fool, you have it. That's what I'm saying. This is a point about human nature. And even if you're a poor man that's associated here with somebody who's humble and really working to fit in well into society and do the best he can under his circumstances and conduct himself wisely before people, whether you're poor and kind of noble in this sense, you've got the same issue. Nobody escapes this appetite problem. There is no advantage to being one or the other. This is inescapable. And that's not minimizing the value of wisdom, but it is saying that there is something fundamental to human nature that your wisdom is not going to take away. And so he comes to this final thought in verse 9. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity, vapor, and a striving after wind. The point of that statement is to be content with what God has given you in the present. Better is the sight of the eyes. In other words, just taking things day by day, moment by moment, what you see of God's provision to be His portion for you, enjoying that in humility and gratitude, instead of constantly wandering all over the place looking for something more, thinking that whatever it is going to finally bring me peace. And if you let your life be ruled by the second part, the wandering of the appetite, then that's what the last line is talking about. When it talks about vapor and striving after wind, that's a reference back to specifically the wandering of the appetite and how we're going to be afflicted with this unsubstantial and frustrating life if we're driven along by our appetites in the wrong direction instead of being satisfied with what the Lord has given us already. If I let my life be ruled by my appetites and be looking to material things to satisfy my cravings, this is going to be the epitaph from God's viewpoint on my tombstone. I mean, what do you want your tombstone to say? And I would imagine that the vast majority of human beings, God would say, vapor and a striving after wind. That's going to be what God's going to say about the life of people who are continually searching and never content with the Lord and with His provision. Do you want your tombstone to say that? Vapor. Here's a person whose life was like air. It just went up in a puff, and he spent his life chasing after wind. And that is the last time that refrain, vapor and chasing after wind, occurs in the book of Ecclesiastes, and it marks the end of the first half of this book. So with our message, we're actually at the middle point of Ecclesiastes. And it ends with that warning about our human nature and about our tendency to discontentedness. Now, if discontent is such a dangerous thing, we would do well to ask the question, how would I know whether I'm discontent? And as I thought about that, a number of answers came to mind. This passage is meant to get us to evaluate ourselves about our contentment with the provision of God and really just enjoying whatever we have and using that in our relationship with Him. How would I know if I'm discontent? Well, here's some possibilities. When material concerns are the dominant issue on my mind, like that's what I'm primarily thinking about and that's what I'm primarily concerned about, and that's the main factor in my decision making, instead of saying I'm a child of God, what has God given me to do and to enjoy, and how does He want me to carry out my life, and what are his goals for my life, instead of just this all-out pursuit for prosperity and earthly success? When that's my drive, that would seem to be an indication of discontented spirit. Or here's another answer: when I am filled with anxiety or restlessness or worry about material things. When, again, if you could just sort of put an x-ray to my brain and know what I'm all worked up about, what keeps me up at night, what I'm anxious about, if it has to do with stuff especially, and whether I can get more or afraid that I'm going to lose what I have, okay, I think that would be an evidence of discontentment. How about this one? When I am slow to give to people in need and clinging to it so much, I can't let go of it, when there's a legitimate need that I could meet. When I am slow to give to the work of God in the world and use my resources for eternal things, and instead of being willing to do that, I'm just investing exclusively or almost exclusively in my material achievements. How about this one? When I am regularly buying things I don't really need. When I'm regularly buying things I don't really need. Or related to that, when I am regularly making poor financial choices that lead to indebtedness. And not to say that all debt is wrong, but this is an enormous problem in our culture. Why? Because people are driven by their appetites instead of being satisfied with God and His provision. How about this one? I know I'm discontent when I'm unable to cope if I lose my possessions. So what happens when trials take some of those things away? Does it make me angry with God? Does it destroy my faith? Does it cause me to reject Him or just to lose it so that I can't deal with life? And finally, here's another possibility, another sign of discontentment. When I pursue material things at the expense of more important things. And we're dealing there especially with the issue of workaholism and how we can be so driven for material prosperity that we ignore more important parts of our portion, like our spiritual health, like maybe our physical health, like our children, like the work of God in the local church. All of these things could be indications that we are discontented people, and this is what this passage God is using to graciously warn us again. Now, let me leave you with three passages from the New Testament very briefly. Number one, how did Jesus teach us to pray when it comes to material things? He said, give us this day our daily bread. Our daily bread, not bread for, you know, the next 10 years. That'll come over the course of the 10 years, but today. And our daily bread, not our daily sort of fill in the blank. What did Paul say in Colossians 3 about covetousness? He said that is idolatry, Colossians 3:5. And in that context, the antidote to the covetousness is not just to say covetousness is bad. You gotta you got to resist that. You got to be content. It is to say, if you then are risen with Christ, seek those things which are above. And the more your heart is taken up with him, both through him expecting eternal bliss and through him enjoying whatever he's given you on earth, your heart through him will be purged from the covetousness. Or what the author of Hebrews said, keep your life free from love of money and be content with what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man can do to me.